This is the second in a series of four podcasts about the IDEO design research methods. So today, last time what we talked about was the look set of techniques, and today we'll talk about a few of the ask techniques. Something that I didn't make clear in the last podcast was that, in fact, there are, you know, even as I talk about some of these, some of the techniques within each of these categories, I'm certainly not able to go through all of them. So, you know, this is just a sampling of some of them that are inside that are salient and that make sense and that are kind of very easy for you to pick up given the projects that you are doing. So today, as I said, we'll be talking a little bit about the ask methods. And asking, of course, has to do with talking to your participants and really trying to figure out, you know, what's going on by trying to, you know, ask them for help, basically. Ask them to give you their understanding of the situation. So the look techniques, I hope you'll have thought that they were very interesting, that they were not probably the first things that you would go to, but that they actually provide a lot of insight as to what's going on often, in a very rich way, because you are there, you know, as part of the environment. But it's not always enough. In fact, what the look techniques are very good at is telling you what is happening in the world, but in fact, they don't tell you why people are doing what they're doing. They don't tell you, they don't always tell you kind of what their goals are or how they're feeling about it. So even though if you were to go and watch, let's say, an HR administrator make use of PeopleSoft and they were doing a very good job of it, it doesn't necessarily tell you that they're very happy with the interface. It doesn't tell you whether or not it's actually getting in their way and that sort of stuff. And so there are many times when, in fact, you do need to actually go and ask your participants for their help, perhaps in the context of something that they're doing, or perhaps, you know, outside of that altogether. So one of the very common techniques that I'm sure you have played a role in, either taking them or perhaps even constructing them, is to construct surveys or to construct questionnaires. And these are essentially a list of questions that you are curious about and are phrased in such a way that people can answer them to help you. These techniques are best used when you are able to send them out to large groups of people. So it's a way of collecting a lot of data, hopefully very quickly. What I hope to show you in the next little bit is that, in fact, it's difficult to construct these surveys and questionnaires in such a way that it will give you very useful information. And in fact, taking the time to pilot these questionnaires and pilot the surveys to make sure that people are actually interpreting the questions as you would like them to is actually quite difficult. So when you're constructing your questionnaire, you need to be very clear on your goals. You need to be clear on your goals in terms of the overall questionnaire. What are you trying to get out of this? What type of information are you trying to discover? And then at the question level, you need to be asking yourself constantly, is this question actually important to have? And can I get rid of this question? And the reason, of course, is because as you've probably experienced when you're doing questionnaires, when there are too many questions, you don't want to do it anymore. Or if you're seeing a question that is very similar to another question, you just go, well, I already answered this. Why am I doing this again? And you lose faith in whoever is giving you the questionnaire. And ultimately, you don't want to do it anymore. And as somebody who is trying to use this as a technique to do research, obviously, you don't want people to be in that situation. You want people to understand what you're doing, have a sense for it, and be able to answer the questions in a way that is meaningful to you, right? There are a couple different kinds of questions. There are open questions and closed questions. Closed questions have a very clear set of answers, right? So asking people a yes-no question, did you take a bus to school today? Did you drive today? Did you walk to school today? Did you bike today to school? You know, these are very closed responses, right? And so, you know, your multiple choices, your, you know, circle from 1 to 7 kind of responses, your yes-no responses, your how old are you responses, these are what we call closed questions. And open questions are much more open. And so you're allowing people to kind of respond perhaps with free text, and in a way that allows them to be far more broad in kind of the way they're responding and the kinds of responses that you'll get. So as a quick example, what do you think about X? You know, what do you think about this interface? That is an open question. You know, which of the following things are things that you might use? A, B, C, and D, and E. And this is an example of a closed question. Both of these are good for certain kinds of applications. They're both good for certain things. And it just depends on your needs. And your needs should actually dictate whether you're using open or closed questions. And likely, as you construct your questionnaire, you will use a mix of both of these things. I think if you think about the how do you get to school question, there's probably some really, if you were just trying to understand, you know, do people make use of the bus? Asking it as a closed question is a perfectly reasonable way of doing it. If you were trying to really understand how it is that people get to work, then perhaps you want to ask it as a semi-open question, because even people that are taking the bus or the C train, maybe they're actually doing a park and ride kind of situation, right? So they're actually driving partway to a parking lot, they're parking their car, and then they're getting into a C train and then going somewhere. Perhaps you discover that, in fact, they share a car with somebody else, and they need to walk somewhere to get into that carpool, right? This tells you additional information. So again, it depends on what you're trying to get at, and that should help you decide whether you're using open or closed questionnaires, or questions in your questionnaire. Rating scales, I think X is a good idea. 1 strongly disagree, 5 strongly agree. This is something that you've probably seen quite commonly. Again, this is an example of a closed question. In sort of item response theory, what they have discovered is that, in fact, what you want is probably between 5 and 7 points on your scale. You can decide whether or not to have it as an odd set of numbers or an even set of numbers. One of the challenges with having an odd set of numbers is that you may end up with a lot of middle of the road responses, which don't give you anything. So if you have a response scale that has 5 points, and everybody is responding with a 3, it becomes very unclear what that means. And so one way of getting around this is to, in fact, have an even number of points on your scale, and that forces people to make a choice between positive and negative, at least in some way. The key to constructing good questionnaires and surveys is to pilot your questionnaire. So give this to people far in advance. And these people that you're giving to, you want to be able to have access to them so that as they're completing the questionnaire, you can ask them, what do you think this question is actually mean? What do you think this question actually means? And is the questionnaire, you know, are there any repeated questions in here? Or are there any repeated questions, not in terms of the wording necessarily, but in terms of conceptually, right? So too much overlap is not a good thing because, as I said, you lose the confidence of your respondents, and then they eventually don't want to respond anymore. Narration is a very common technique in design, and what you do is you have people complete tasks, perhaps using a new interface that you have built or using an existing interface that they already have, and you basically ask them to think out loud what they're and describe what they're doing and describe to you, you know, what they're trying to do right now. And this works really, really well when people are struggling, because it tells you what they're actually thinking, right? So they may actually be thinking of certain words and they're looking for those words in the interface and they're not finding them. And that tells you perhaps that you need to change the interface, that in fact people have a different vocabulary of how they're conceptualizing what is going on. So this narration or think aloud technique is something that we commonly use. A quick example of this is, in the past, I was trying to understand how people were making use of certain features in Visual Studio. And I would have them actually try to complete certain tasks. And these tasks are actually really straightforward, right? I want you to create a web project. So this person would sit down in the chair, and they would start a Visual Studio, and they would start to look under new, basically, right? New solution, new project, new file. And they were starting, and then once they kind of got through that step, then they would try to look for web project. I think at the time we had a different label for it. I'm just making this up now because I don't really remember, but it might have been like .NET, you know, soap project or whatever. And so what became clear was that people's mental model of and vocabulary for understanding what they were trying to do was very different from the labels that were inside of Visual Studio itself. And having this insight was very useful because what it meant was we actually went in and changed some of those labels so that it matched people's expectations. But we wouldn't have figured this out had we not had them think out loud, right? So we're asking them, and you could hear them saying things. They would say things like, okay, so I'm looking for a web project, maybe something to do with HTTP, you know, all of these things. And what became clear, as I said, was that, you know, the labels were just incorrect, and there was a clear mismatch between what their expectations and, you know, the goals that they had and the interface that was being presented to them. Foreign correspondence is another technique that you can use. So if you are building sort of a cross-cultural type of application, it turns out that that people interpret things differently depending on the culture that they're coming from. This probably shouldn't be that much of a surprise, but I think the point of this technique is to get outside perspective on what's going on. And that frequently means going outside of your engineering and software engineering and design team and asking for other people's feedback on the designs that you have. And in particular, what you're looking for there are often people that are sort of non-technical, people that are not essentially building code. Because the culture that we are in, you know, all these computer scientists, as we sit in the lecture hall together, we have a certain way of thinking about the world. We have a certain way of, you know, describing what is happening on the network. We have a certain way of describing what is happening when the system isn't working well. Right? We have a certain set of expectations about how systems should actually work. And going outside of this and looking into different cultures, not necessarily just, you know, geographical cultures or ethnic cultures and all that stuff, but outside of different, when you think about different types of work cultures, you get different insight into problems. And so something that's quite common that you'll find, you know, just as you're browsing the web probably, is that, you know, when you find websites that are coming from different cultures, they use color in different ways. They use fonts in different ways. The example that I've got here is a couple images of online shopping experiences. And, you know, there's a Japanese one that is very colorful. It's got a lot of use of, you know, different images and stuff like this. And if you go on to Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, you have a very different experience where it's where there's a lot less stuff to look at here. And a word that we might use is clean, but that's, you know, only a Western interpretation of what's going on here. And in fact, it turns out that on Japanese sites, having these colors, having lots of images and things to look at, this is a way of building confidence. and this is an example of cultural differences. So in particular, when you are contracting out experiences to be designed kind of from other cultures, or you are building for a different culture, you need to understand that, you know, your expectations and your assumptions are often going to be wrong. Another technique is to use what we call camera journals, and this recognizes the problem that you can't always be there to see what's going on. And so what you're asking people do is to collect images and things from their experiences. So one of the projects that I was really interested in early on was how is it that people actually do, when and how do people actually read? And the question we were sort of, the broader question that we were asking was, are Kindles and Nooks good for work-related reading? And what they gave people was these paper logs that would fit into their pocket, and they were just, you know, about the size of a tiny piece of notepad, a tiny notepad. And they would give these people these templates to fill out, and you can kind of see in this image the kinds of things that they were being asked to fill out. What day was it? What time of day is it? Where are you? What are you reading? What are you doing in addition to the reading? And who or what are you working with? And so this is something that they gave the people to use, let's say for a week or maybe 2 weeks, and they collected all this information, and they were able to understand people's reading experiences. And what they found was that people write a lot when they read. They search and find things frequently, annotations are common, and that single displays may be inadequate because sometimes you need to look at multiple things or multiple pages to compare things. So this is, to me, a great argument as to why Kindles and Nooks are just kind of an awful idea when it comes to textbooks, right? When you're reading your textbook, you're trying to flip between things, you're trying to understand different concepts and as they relate to one another. And so these Kindles and Nooks don't provide a really great mechanism to have that experience. And in fact, the Kindle and Nook really kind of force you into a certain kind of learning style that may not be exactly what everybody else does. Experience sampling is another thing that's related to this. So this is all under sort of camera journaling, but these are all sort of related techniques, but in the sense that we ask people to do similar types of things, but they're all, you know, we have different labels for them. Experience sampling is when you have people carry around a device that has them answer questions at intervals. So perhaps a cell phone, a PDA, or a pager. And so a pager might actually remind somebody to do something every once in a while. And as a quick example, this I think came from a product or project where people were trying to design tools to help people sleep better, or tools to give people advice on how to sleep better. And it would ring a person up every 3 hours and ask them to fill out a short survey on the current activity and to rate their sleepiness level. So whereas the diary study was asking people to do it sort of as the activity came up or as they remembered, the experience sampling is actually kind of pinging you and saying, okay, what are you doing right now? What are you doing right now? I love this little image here. How convenient was this questionnaire? And actually that came up in my colleagues' projects, which was ridiculous, I think. So a collage. So sometimes people have a hard time necessarily articulating what their experiences or what their motivations or their goals or how they feel about certain things well. And so you can actually have them construct a collage for you. Why you do this, it illustrates participants' understanding and perceptions of issues and helps them to verbalize complex or unimagined themes. Basically, you're getting at something that somebody is feeling or thinking. And when it comes down to it, often people are quite have a hard time articulating that. And so giving them the ability to kind of do this in a different way, to kind of externalize that stuff, is really great for you to see what's going on. Related to this is draw the experience. So something that they're thinking. Tell me how you're thinking about this. And rather than asking people, you may actually just have them draw it. This set of two images actually comes from a project where they were trying to understand how it is that people understand their home networks. Turns out that routers, wireless routers, are the most frequently returned piece of hardware because, and I think there's a bunch of interesting reasons for this, one of which is that you can't really see how it's working or whether it's working, right? It's kind of this mysterious object. And what you see between these two images, if you look carefully, is that in the second one, this is a very sort of technical perspective on what's going on. Here's my rack. This is connected to a switch. This is connected in the desktop and the camera connected to this switch. My Xbox is connected right into the blah, 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 so on and so forth. It's a very technical perspective on what's going on. I think the second image is far more frequently the kinds of stuff that, you know, real people's perceptions of what is happening in their network. And here what you see is that this image is organized in terms of the things that are in people's rooms, and then it's just organized in terms of the rooms, right? So they have some notion of some central networking. They know that there are some connections basically going through these different rooms, and then there are things in the rooms. In the bedroom, there's a CPU, right? And this is not to say that, oh, people are stupid, but the point is to say, this is the extent of about 90% of our participants' understanding of what is happening with their home network. And it tells us a lot about how we should go about designing the software that runs on the routers that makes this stuff work, or even the help material that people can use to figure this stuff out.
there is this next set of images, I think, is something that's really cool. It's just a project that I saw last year. And what's going on here is they had people draw maps of cities. And the idea was that these maps help you navigate better than Google Maps. And these maps basically outline areas, groups of areas, basically. And what they did was, and what they did was, they actually had people, you know, draw maps of their city as they understood it, and then they would make these refined versions that actually captured these inside and belonging with and next to and above and next to and below and stuff like this, these relationships, and then they would draw these maps. So this is a picture of Portland. Obviously, when you look at Google Maps, it looks different from this. But actually, my bet is that if you had something like this, this would give you great insight into kind of how people perceived Portland. Same kind of thing, right? So here's a quick example of, you know, what somebody would draw. Here's a map of Washington, D.C. And you can very easily imagine what a map of Calgary might look like, right? It's actually, you know, it would be divided into quadrants. You know, you might have, you know, some of the burbs up near the top, you know, some of the burbs down near the south, and then you'd have some of this, you know, more interesting stuff happening in the center, so on and so forth. You see these popping up every once in a while, and they're often quite interesting because they give you insight into, again, how it is that people are thinking about what is happening. And these are, again, from drawn experiences. I want to get into really briefly a card sorting technique. So often you have a system that provides a whole bunch of features, probably too many features, right? And one of the questions you might have is, well, how should I organize these inside of a menu structure? And one technique that is very useful, it turns out, is to put each feature onto a different card and then to ask people that you expect to use your system to sort these into groups and categories. And that gives you a sense of how people think things should be organized, which is really, really cool. So some quick concepts that I want to run by you. Mental model. A mental model is a thought process or understanding of how something works. So a great example of this is your thermostat at home. So often something that people do is they get home, it's cold, and they, you know, jack up the thermostat to, let's say, 30 degrees. Right? That's ridiculous, but they just jack it right up to the top. And their mental model of how the system works is that, you know, if I jack it up to 30, the temperature and the heat in the room is going to go up faster than if I only turn it up to 30, you know, 28. And in fact, it turns out that this is a false mental model. For most homes, the thermostat simply turns on the furnace, and the furnace just basically fires up. And when the house gets to kind of that temperature, it turns off. But the rate at which your house heats up is not related to what temperature you set it to. So the mental model is not always consistent with what is actually happening in the system. But nevertheless, it is how people think of what's going on. Some other concepts: work process and work practices. So if you've ever been to a job where they say, you know, this is how you're supposed to do it, and then they say afterwards, okay, this is how we really do it. That's the difference between work process and work practice. So work process is a formal articulation of how to get something done, whereas a work practice is kind of informal ways in which people get things done in a context. So the image here is, you know, how to hand wash, but obviously people take shortcuts on this all of the time. I want to wrap this up really quickly by talking about contextual inquiry. So contextual inquiry is a technique that you use where you sort of combine looking and asking by immersing yourself into a particular context. And the point is to understand what the mental models are and what the work practices are. I'll just read this. The core premise of contextual inquiry is very simple. Go to where the customer works, observe the customer as he or she works, talk to the customer about their work. Do that and you can't help but gain a better understanding of your customer. So rather than simply conducting an interview by bringing people into your office or bringing them into your home or whatever it might be, go to actually where they are doing their work and sit there and watch what they were doing. And then furthermore, when you're asking the questions, you can ask them the questions while they're there. I think a great example of this for me, it's not exactly the same, but I think you'll see how this story relates. Turns out, if you have a kid in Alberta, so and you bring the kid home, so you know you have an infant now that's like 2 days old, Alberta will actually send a health worker to your home to answer your questions in your home. And they'll just do it. It's not really an interview. It's just kind of like to help you to make sure everything is going well and that sort of stuff. And if you think about that in contrast to how you might do it if you weren't thinking very hard, you would just have people come in for checkups, right? So bring your baby in a couple days and we'll check them out, right? So as a parent, I can tell you that those first couple days are insane. You have no sleep. You're not really sure what you're doing. All this stuff. And so actually having the health worker in your home, you have all of these cues in your environment, right? The bottle is lying on the ground. You've got, you know, some diapers that are kind of half done. And you have all these questions, right? Like, oh, I don't know if I should be doing this. I don't know if I should be doing that. But being in the environment gives you all these cues. Seeing them reminds you of these questions that you had come up but had nobody to answer them for you. And so in the same way, when you do the contextual inquiry in the context of the person's work, it's far easier for you to think of the questions that are important for you to ask or for them to give you answers that are sort of correct in the context. Why is this important? Some principles of doing a contextual inquiry. The context, you want to be doing in the setting of the participant. As a relationship, remember that you know absolutely nothing, that in fact the participant is the expert. You need to interpret everything that you're seeing, right? So observed facts must be considered for design implications. So when you see something, how does that relate to design? You need to have some kind of focus when you're going into this because there are so many things that are going on. Again, just really quickly, the expert and apprentice relationship. You are the noob. Remember what this means, right? It means that you need to be a keen observer. You want to ask questions, be eager to learn. You want to, you know, have them feel like you admire everything that they're doing, right? Because everything that you're doing is basically considered as being perfect and you want to know what it is. You know, aspire to see the world as the expert does. So if you go in with that mindset and you are able to convey that to your participant, they're much more open to you and telling you what they do. So what is the difference between all of these techniques broadly compared to an interview? Well, in an interview, you're typically getting some summaries. Whereas a lot of these techniques are actually asking people to kind of respond in the moment. And if you just take a look at these two descriptors, the abstract summary that you get a lot more richness with the ongoing experience description because it tells you a lot more of what's going on. It tells you a lot more of what people's practices are. And that gives you, or perhaps inspires better design. So just really quickly, broad assumption in user-centered design. As designers, we know very little, and the ask methods complement the look methods to help us discover what is happening and why. Some concepts that are important to remember, there's mental model, work practices and work processes, surveys and questionnaires, you know, all these different techniques that we talked about, and contextual inquiry combines these ideas into a single technique. With that, thank you very much. Tune in next time.